This is the takeaway for Tuesday, December 27th, 2016.
This is The Takeaway. I'm Todd Zwillick in for John Hockenberry all this week, and we thank you so much for listening. Hope you had a lovely holiday with loved ones if you're celebrating this week. It's the last week of 2016, a 2016 where a lot of people, let's be honest, just want it to end. Divisive politics, a strange and unsettling election, artists from Bowie to Prince, and now George Michael leaving us right when we needed them. We'll have a little more on George Michael later this hour, but at the end of this 2016, we've been asking you what you do around this time of year to give back. Do you donate your time, your money? We want to hear your story, so give us a call. 877-8-MY-TAKE is the number. But we begin this hour with news out of Israel. The Israeli government says they will move ahead with plans to build thousands of new settlements in the West Bank and a predominantly Palestinian section of East Jerusalem. It's a message of defiance from the government of Benjamin Netanyahu after a Security Council resolution passed on Friday at the UN condemning the construction of these projects, calling them a flagrant violation under international law. The United States did something new. It abstained from voting at the Security Council, an apparent change in U.S. policy towards Israel at the UN. And that brought swift and sharp reaction against the Obama administration from Israel, from Israeli hawks here in the U.S., and from President-elect Donald Trump, who said things would be different when he takes office. Meanwhile, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his lieutenants say President Obama didn't just abstain from that vote, but orchestrated the resolution critical of Israel in the first place. Here's Netanyahu speaking on Christmas Day.
Over decades, American administrations and Israeli governments have disagreed about settlements. But we agreed that the Security Council was not the place to resolve this issue. We knew that going there would make negotiations harder and drive peace further away.
Well, in the aftermath, ambassadors were recalled, relationships suspended, a final act of a U.S. administration with an already strained relationship with its ally Israel. But could all this change under a new President Trump? A lot of people in Israel certainly hope so.
Thank God in 25 days we will see a change in the American administration and also a change in American policy. And President-elect Trump already made clear that he's our policy is going to be totally different.
That's Israel's regional cooperation minister speaking over the weekend. Joining us now once again is Daniel Levy. He's president of the U.S. Middle East Peace Project. Daniel Levy, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Good to be back with you, Todd.
Well, a similar resolution at the UN was vetoed in 2011, not this one. And there have been a lot of interpretations of this move by the Obama administration since the weekend, you know, a final swipe at Benjamin Netanyahu on Barack Obama's way out the door, or a marker to highlight that Donald Trump's apparent pro-settlement policy is itself a big departure from current U.S. policy. How do you see this battle at the UN Security Council over settlements and over the U.S.-Israel relationship?
Well, I think first we have to understand that there are important differences in the substance of the resolution that was voted on in the text as compared to the 2011 text, which, as you rightly mentioned, was vetoed by the Obama administration. There are things in this text which recognize not only the settlements, the illegality, the problem that that is causing, but also the deliverables on the Palestinian side. There's a reference to incitement and its prevention, terror and its prevention, security cooperation. So there are things in there substantively which meant that for the Obama administration, they could justifiably claim that they were not crossing the line in terms of allowing a one-sided resolution to pass, because this is not a one-sided resolution. In addition, there are issues of timing. In 2011, there were prospects of negotiations, and the Obama administration felt that the timing was wrong. But crucially, we also have now, since 2011, 5 more years of experiencing relentless settlement expansion and an ever more confident, some might argue overconfident, Israeli government and Israeli right wing, which are pushing the envelope. They're moving the goalposts on the entire way of dealing with the territories. And that is new, and that was central to the Obama administration explaining why they did not veto. And let's remember, virtually, and I think it is since the 1967 war, every U.S. administration, every president has in fact presided over a Security Council resolution on this issue. Obama was the first president not to do so. It's not the other way round, which people are claiming, that this is the first time America has allowed something to pass. That is not the case. And this was not driven by America. The idea that this was some plot behind Israel's back is not borne out by the facts, despite the claims of the Israelis.
And I want to ask you about that, because, of course, the accusation from the Israeli government now is that not only did the Obama administration fail to veto an anti-Israel resolution, as they see it, but in fact orchestrated its authorship, let it go, and then didn't veto it to kind of take this swipe at the Netanyahu government. And of course, Netanyahu says he'll present evidence of this when Obama's no longer president.
First of all, I apologize, share everything with your listeners, but being privy to quite a lot of the negotiations and background that was going on behind this resolution, that is simply not an accurate portrayal. America did not put forward this resolution. This resolution was initially put forward by Egypt, then taken up by four other co-sponsors. And let's remember here, America was the only country not to vote yes. All of the vitriol that is coming out of the Netanyahu government in Israel is directed primarily at the United States, but the United States was the only country not to vote in favor. What we're really seeing is a pushback from the Netanyahu government that is primarily, and we're dealing with this and we should be dealing with this, but the target audience for Netanyahu is primarily the domestic audience. That's understandable. The thing that he most has to deal with is his domestic politics. And why the pushback has been so aggressive is that this rips a big hole in a central claim of Netanyahu, which is that the world doesn't care about the Palestinians, the world doesn't care about the settlements. I've got this. This is manageable. Don't worry. And he was claiming that he had made great strides in advancing Israel's relations around the world, in Africa, in Asia, with Arab states. And of course, there were a few pesky annoyances like the Obama administration, but they were out on a limb on this. And this resolution has proven that there is a global international consensus against the settlements, against the occupation. So he's chosen to target the Obama administration, to create a distraction from that, to play a risky domestic political hand. But it is quite astonishing, the language that is coming out of the Israeli government against a US administration that has done so much for Israel. They are, in their own actions, turning this into a partisan American political issue. It's something Netanyahu has done before. It is something that I think in the long term will be very ill-advised for the Israelis.
And it's something you and I have talked about before, even on the show, that the continued isolation of most, not all, American Jews from policies of the Israeli government, policies of American Israel hawks and others, and that certainly seems to be deepening here.
Well, absolutely. And this is not going anywhere, this conflict. The Israelis aren't going anywhere. The Palestinians aren't going anywhere. And if Netanyahu and his ilk, those on the right in government with him, continue on this turbocharged path of both settlements and killing the two-state option, and of becoming part of a trend on the right of illiberal, ethno-nationalist democracy, this is perhaps building up some real problems for the future. That future may lie beyond the political horizons of Netanyahu. So from his perspective, it may not be a big deal. From Israel's perspective, it could be a very big deal indeed.
And it sounds like, Danny Levy, what you might be suggesting is Benjamin Netanyahu now, after this confrontation at the Security Council, knowing he can put down a very conservative marker, right? Donald Trump is going to appoint David Friedman as U.S.-Israel ambassador, somebody staunchly pro-settlement, staunchly pro-Israel, criticized already for being a real kind of American-Israel hawk. And the message, it seems, to the world is that there's at least a couple of years of a pause button here on any attempt for a two-state solution, if not killing it entirely.
Well, we're on a prolonged pause, and the prolonged pause is on the two-state solution. The prolonged pause is primarily driven by the continued Israeli moves to render meaningless the idea of a Palestinian state by taking more Palestinian land, legalizing previous confiscations, entrenching rather than beginning to undo Israeli control. But what the question that I think we'll be asking ourselves soon is, with the Trump administration, is it what you see is what you get? Trump himself, the appointment or the nomination of this chap Friedman to be the ambassador, some of the comments of the national security advisor to be General Flynn, all of these things suggest that Israel will be able to do its worst when it comes to settlement activity. That's one option. That option may not play out so well for Netanyahu, because if an already overconfident Israeli right goes too far, this could cause backlash, not in America perhaps, but elsewhere in the world, in the Arab world, amongst the Palestinians, and perhaps even domestically, if, and this is what has happened in the last days since the resolution, if the Israeli public see that these policies are not serving them. The other alternative is that there will be others in the room of the Trump administration who say, wait a minute, this may be nice to have this love affair with Netanyahu, but does it serve the American national interest when Netanyahu is doing things with his government that undermine American interests, make America look bad, that has security blowback consequences, and it further destabilizes an already destabilized region? That is the position that General Mattis took when he was head of the Central Command of the American military, and he is the nominate to be defense secretary. So it's not a given that giving Netanyahu carte blanche and the blowback that may cause for America is going to be the sustained Trump policy. And the other thing he's going to face is that if the message to the Palestinians is action at the United Nations, diplomatic political action, is blocked, it's finished, there's nowhere to go with it, then the signal you're sending is that nonviolence has no prospects. And that is a terrible signal to send to people living under the conditions of dispossession and disenfranchisement that characterize Palestinian existence. Because then you're giving a huge shot in the arm to the hardliners who would prefer to pursue other means.
There are many, many signals being sent after a vote in the UN Security Council 14-0 condemning settlements in Israel, and an apparent or at least optical change in U.S. foreign policy, or at least U.S. attitude toward Israel as Barack Obama leaves his administration. Danny Levy, president of the U.S. Middle East Peace Project, thank you for joining us once again.
My pleasure. Thank you, Todd. Oh, yeah.
There have been hours and hours of George Michael tributes all across the media this weekend. So we wanted to focus in on one aspect of George Michael's remarkable career, how his own struggle with his sexuality and ultimate fearless public advocacy helped change not only pop culture, but the broader culture that reacts to it. Michael Musto is a writer for The Village Voice in New York, and he writes a weekly column at Out.com, and he joins me in the studio now. Michael, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Well, there's been a lot of tribute to George Michael's music and his self-professed struggle with fame, you know, all throughout the weekend. But he was an artist who performed in the 80s at a time when gay artists were not out. Freddie Mercury comes to mind, you know, a hugely famous performer around the same time that George Michael first got known. And then George Michael kind of came into a gay identity right around the time when straight people were starting to be okay with it in the culture. It seems like he was a big part of that.
Well, I think Elton John breaks all the rules. He was a pioneer in being an out artist in the music industry. But you're right. In the 1980s, at the height of New Wave, when Wham started out, that was George Michael's synth pop duo with Andrew Ridgeley, there were very few out gay artists. And it was weird when Boy George, who was sort of a rival singer for another New Wave band, Culture Club, later on started railing in the press against George Michael for being in the closet, because Boy George, when he was at his peak of fame, was not out of the closet. He was ambiguous. He admitted to being a drag queen, but not a gay man. So it was a little bit messy, but by the time George Michael came out, and by the way, he only came out because he was busted looking for, quote, lewd, anonymous sex in a public restroom, There was no turning back. He really became a very visible and vocal LGBT member who did us proud, I would say.
And all of these acts, I call them acts that we're talking about, I mentioned Freddie Mercury, George Michael, Boy George, all British. There was a renaissance in pop culture attention to gay culture in the late 90s, maybe the early 2000s, I would say, in this country. It seems like England, the UK, in the way that you're describing, was way ahead of us.
Well, in the 90s, AIDS was mounting, and it, in a very macabre way, it really put a spotlight on the gay community, and Madonna was somebody who was fanning the flames and catering to her gay audience. And so by the time George Michael came out, gay was very much in the public eye. It was headline news, and yeah, there's something about the British who I think who foster a taste for slightly unconventional artists. If you notice, there are people who would never make it in the Billboard charts who are big in England, even though, you know, people like the Scissor Sisters or Anani or... people like Adele and Sam Smith kind of were big in England before they made it here.
So Michael Musto, 2016 has sort of put a lens on it. You know, we have Bowie, Prince, now George Michael, pop stars, all who bent and reshaped sexuality. Probably for a lot of people, their first exposure to that type of queerness, I'll call it, in pop culture, not on the fringes. George Michael was also part of that. And this year, it seems, for some reason, all three of these gentlemen have left us. How do you internalize all that?
Things always happen in threes. Whenever I'm looking for an article to write for the New York Times style section, I'm always thinking of three examples, and that'll make for an article. And it just happens that way. It's in the zeitgeist. There's no reason behind it other than coincidence. But David Bowie was bisexual. Prince was certainly comfortable with gender and sexuality, flounced around like a little lavender elf full of hormones, and was a riveting performer. And George Michael, of course, eventually was openly gay. And all three of them were pioneers in the arenas of sexuality and gender. And it's important that they all be remembered, not just for their body of work, but for how they paved the way for other people. There are certainly way more openly gay performers in music today, and it's an inspiring thing to see. And I'm glad George Michael actually lived to see that happen, because he was partly responsible for it.
Have you thought about how much of an impact pop culture figures like George Michael, Bowie, Prince, Sam Smith, others that we're talking about, have had on the broader politics, right? We can talk about MTV being comfortable with gayness or queerness in pop culture. In politics, you have the Obergefell decision, a new acceptance of gay marriage, an acceptance of gay people and gay culture that's far different than it was 20 years ago. How related are these two things?
Very related. And in fact, whenever there's an anti-gay thing happening in politics, you know, bathroom rights for trans people, you have artists like George Michael who have a huge following, and what their message is, I'm gay, so what? My fans love me. And that's the most important message of an out gay artist in music like George Michael, is that, well, they're gay. It's part of who they are. And the public not only accepts them, they worship them.
Let's talk about George Michael and his music for a second, because when he passed away, I read 100 million albums sold.
It's true.
Astronomical figure. I never would have pegged him in such a club.
Well, when you look back at the hits, I mean, once he went solo after Wham, which had kind of lightweight hits like Wake Me Up Before You Go-Go, George Michael went on to songs like Faith, Father Figure, I Want Your Sex. It was hit after hit. It was
Careless really, Whisper.
Yeah, exactly. So it was an astounding array of hit records. Kept showing his range. He had a duet with Aretha Franklin, I Knew You Were Waiting For Me. And that he did that because he actually had roots in R&B and was desperate to sing with the greatest singer of all time, and he held his own.
But he was more than just a pop artist making bubblegum, right? I mean, Wham, you could argue there was a place for that. There was a lot of neon orange and pink going on at the time.
Yes.
His solo career was more substantive. I mean, he was living his struggles through his art. It wasn't just artifice.
Absolutely. I mean, Wham was a very pop confection that was cute and disposable. And it was inevitable that George Michael was going to go solo, much like years later. Beyonce was obviously going to break out of Destiny's Child and go solo. It just reeked of, you know, this guy has star quality. And as he did emerge into his own career, he really developed as an artist and dug into all of his roots, from R&B to dance to pop and rock, and came up with an amazing array of very diverse songs that really hit a chord with the public.
So I don't want to oversell George Michael's contribution, but in the context of people like Bowie and Prince, inevitably they all pass this year, the rule of threes, Michael Musto, as we talked about. His overall contribution to people that you've talked to, people who might have been kids in the 80s and the 90s, their testimonials about what his career might have meant to them. What have you heard?
What they're all saying on Facebook is, I was a kid of the 80s, and this has been a devastating year between Bowie, Prince, and George Michael, not to mention Natalie Cole. These are people who represented cutting-edge music and trends and explorations and, as you say, working out personal issues through their music and advancing music by daring to try on new adventures.
Michael Musto, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Michael Musto is a writer for The Village Voice in New York City. Also, he writes a weekly column at Out.com, joining us to talk about the life and career of George Michael. Evidence continues to mount that the Russian government was behind the hack on the Democratic National Committee that played such a sizable role in the presidential election. Cybersecurity firm CrowdStrike released a report last week that links both the malware used at the DNC and malware used on a hack of Ukrainian fighters to one cyber espionage group called Fancy Bear. CrowdStrike says it has a medium level of confidence that Fancy Bear is connected with Russian military intelligence. With new cyber threats popping up all the time, the face of politics and war are changing. Some cybersecurity experts are calling for better cyber deterrence, stopping hackers, large and small, from acting in the first place. Chris Demchak is the Grace M. Hopper Professor of Cybersecurity and Professor of the Cyber Conflict Center at the U.S. Naval War College. Chris, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hello.
So, Professor, we should probably take a minute here and define our terms, because people are familiar with cybersecurity, but we're talking about deterrence here, trying to prevent an adversary, an enemy, even a hacker, from even thinking about it or trying it. So what does deterrence look like these days?
Well, deterrence today is often viewed through the lens of the Cold War and the way we viewed how you deterred adversaries from using nuclear weapons. There are three main elements of a Cold War definition of deterrence, and that is denial, punishment, and entanglement. The difficulty was nukes are very few sources, very high consequences, very low probabilities. So it was left to governments to negotiate with single adversaries or to chase down rogue adversaries. Cyberspace, on the other hand, is a global substrate connecting all elements of society with a grand multitude of sources, low to high consequences, just depends, and low to high probabilities. So to deter bad consequences in a large-scale complex system like that, you need to kind of change the emphasis of that set of four. Norms are hard to do because there's too many people playing. Entanglement, well, everybody's entangling, but it's already breaking up. And punishment has its own issues. And denial is what's left, and we've placed the least amount of emphasis on that because so many private sector actors are involved. And yet, to deter the kinds of consequences that we concern ourselves with, we need to talk about the first, the denial, before we talk about punishment. And by the way, the term of art for that is resilience.
So, Chris Demchak, we should stress that you're speaking from your own expertise here and not reflecting the positions of the U.S. Navy or the U.S. government or the War College where you work. But that type of denial that you're talking about, does this mean a new culture among, you know, all the corporations, private entities like the DNC, frankly, or other political organizations that takes deterrence more seriously, that puts up higher and thicker firewalls, I guess, so that fewer people think about getting over them or through them?
The short answer would be yes, but let me put some meat on that. Let me say that the answer has to be systemic. There are leftover notions from the 90s and the aughts about cyberspace as this beautiful, warm cloud that doesn't need governments and nobody needs to govern it. But it's actually owned, operated by somebody, somewhere, everywhere. And those people get a vote. And those people simply have to play in this denial. And that includes the folks that design those apps you use. They have to recognize they have a role to play in cleaning up this poorly designed system. And furthermore, what we designed is not being used the same way outside of Europe, the U.S., and our normal like-minded allies. They're being used by autocratic countries to control their people. That's not going away. We're not going to change that. They're being used in rules in ways that we didn't anticipate when we created this seemingly free knowledge generator. And so now we have to adapt as well. The private sector is the key. And the private sector has to stand up and say, right, it's changing. Jurisdictions are rising. Countries are claiming their own cyberspace. And they're not going to let us play as they did during the Cold War when we were the dominant economic actor in the world.
Chris Demchak is director of the Cyber Conflict Center at the U.S. Naval War College. Professor, thank you.
Thank you.
Welcome back. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. There's a fog over London now, but it's not the romantic kind. A toxic cloud of pollution has settled over the city, bad enough to divert flights and even delay trains over the past couple of weeks. Now, London has tried to cut its CO2 emissions by replacing gas vehicles, or petrol vehicles, as they would call them, with diesel-powered cars and trucks. But there's a big drawback. Diesel exhaust contains nitrogen dioxide, also called NOx, a proven human toxin that causes respiratory and cardiovascular disease. Martin Williams is a professor at King's College in London and an air quality scientist, and he joins me now. Professor Williams, welcome.
Hello.
Just how bad is the problem in London right now?
Well, it's bad. It's not as bad as it used to be in the 50s and 60s and even earlier in the days of Charles Dickens and so on, when things were really bad. But it's bad, and it's responsible for many thousands of premature deaths a year, not just NOx, nitrogen dioxide, but also the particles that come from diesels too.
How are people reacting in London? Are they staying off the streets or wearing masks? What's the effect on the ground?
It's not quite that bad. I mean, you don't see too many people wearing masks. There's a lot of concern over it, and the new mayor is actually responding to a lot of public opinion and a lot of media interest to take steps to minimize the pollution in London these days.
Well, Professor Williams, you know, one of the questions here is whether regulators should have seen this coming. I mean, there's a long history of smog in cities around the world, including here in the U.S., nitrogen dioxide, but also sulfur dioxide, the old NOx and SOx. In many ways, it seems like these were largely problems of the past. So how could regulators not have seen an air pollution problem coming if they started burning a lot of diesel? It seems pretty logical.
It does with hindsight, doesn't it?
Yeah.
At the time, though, we could foresee increasingly stringent emission standards for road vehicles coming on stream. And so we thought at the time that these regulations would actually reduce the air pollution emissions, and so that, you know, we could reduce CO2 emissions by using more diesel, because we thought diesels would get progressively cleaner. Now, there's actually been a really major regulatory failure in Europe. The emission regulations for diesel cars just haven't worked. The laboratory tests that manufacturers have to pass to sell diesels in Europe turns out to be not stringent enough at all.
Well, Martin Williams, it might be too early to answer this question, but nitrogen dioxide is a known human toxin, has effects on asthma, on breathing, on lung function, heart function. That's all proven. Have there been any noticeable health effects so far during this latest smog invasion?
It's difficult to tell instantly, days after an episode like this, because, you know, the statistics don't come in, and it takes some time to gather the statistics and do the analysis. But events in the past have shown that there have been effects from both NOx, NO2, and from particles. So I would expect that, you know, in future years, or months, when the analysis is done, that we'd certainly see these effects. Yeah.
And as you mentioned, this certainly isn't the first time. Let's just take the modern era that Londoners have experienced this. I mean, 1952, you had an event called the Great Smog. Thousands of people mm-hmm. died.
Absolutely. I mean, the causes then were different, of course. I mean, those big events, there was one in 52 and one again 10 years later in 62, when thousands of people died in a week. That was caused by coal burning. Pretty much everything in London was heated with coal in those days. That's been completely banned, of course. And now we've got a different problem. We've now got the road traffic problem.
Well, in the short term, Martin Williams, it sounds like a change in the weather is all Londoners can hope for, right? A strong wind for now?
Well, that's one in the short term, yes. In the longer term, there are measures now to make a large part of London what's called an ultra-low emission zone. So you'd have to pay a financial penalty to take an older polluting car into the into the central area of London. In the long term, the whole of the UK transport fleet is anticipated to become electric.
Well, in the meantime, Londoners wait for that strong wind. A new toxic cloud, smog over their city, away from their lives. Nitrogen dioxide has returned to London. Martin Williams, professor at King's College and an air quality scientist there. Thank you for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Welcome back to The Takeaway. It's Todd Zwillick with you today. Many American soldiers who served in Iraq and Afghanistan have spent years now dealing with the mental and emotional consequences of war, including post-traumatic stress disorder. Many others have wounds like traumatic brain injury or amputation. But a lot of other soldiers, though, are suffering from a type of physical battle scar that's harder to see. Up to 60,000 veterans are suffering from the effects of giant burn pits set up near camps across the Middle East during war. They're operated by military contractors like Kellogg Brown & Root, which is a former subsidiary of Halliburton. Jennifer Percy is with me. She's a contributing editor at The New Republic who investigated the burn pits. Her article, The Things They Burned, can be read in the December issue of The New Republic. Also, Senior Master Sergeant Jesse Baca, who did two tours in Iraq, he's been diagnosed with a terminal illness after exposure to open landfills packed with the burning refuse of modern war. Batteries, chemicals, food, entire vehicles, even human body parts, all set ablaze with jet fuel. Jesse Baca says the U.S. government has refused to fully acknowledge the impact of these burn pits on his health and the health of thousands of other veterans.
Pretty much all the trash that was collected from all the living areas was collected and thrown over there. And I witnessed myself seeing, you know, tires, vehicles, computers, all the batteries that run all those things thrown in there on top of all the medical waste, because the base was a hub for all the wounded coming through. So literally everything that could get thrown in there was thrown in there.
You said vehicles, entire vehicles, cars, trucks?
Yes. If there were vehicles were damaged or destroyed or no longer functional, push them in there. And there was no other place to put them away.
Jennifer, you were also told that there were not only body parts, but entire bodies being thrown into burn pits at one point.
There were bodies being thrown into the burn pit. And when I talked to one of the soldiers about that and how he reacted, he said that he was told not to worry because they weren't Americans. They were foreigners.
Did soldiers like you, your comrades, have a sense that this was extremely unhealthy or unsafe, or did they joke about it? What was it like?
Well, when I first got there, I was given a briefing by my superiors, and they told me anticipate some of your subordinates getting sick, so you have to plan accordingly. And the joke was we called it the Iraqi crud. And sure enough, within hours, some within days, some within weeks, started getting sick. You know, like a real bad flu-like symptom. And some of them, you know, recovered rather quickly. Others stayed sick, and myself included. And, you know, you'd have the shortness of breath, your skin's burning, your eyes are burning, and it would never go away. You know, you'd go to the hospital and get medicines or some kind of relief systematically, but it always stayed with us.
Jesse, can you describe what it was like to be near the fire just in terms of the amount of smoke, the smell?
The smell was to the point of making you physically ill. You felt like you were going to lose your lunch just smelling it. My shift, I used to go in at midnight to 12 noon. We used to split the heat of the day with everybody. It looked like the San Francisco fog, except it was blue with a gray haze to it. And it was literally up to your knees.
And Jesse, what about your own medical condition now? What have your doctors said about your health now, these many years later?
My diagnosis is called constrictive bronchiolitis, which is a small airways disease. The smallest points in your lung are burned, and it's a terminal condition, and I'm not a candidate for a lung replacement.
So, Jennifer Percy, many of these burn pits were run by private contractors. We've heard a lot over the years about the role that big military contractors, private companies had. But what is the government saying, the Pentagon saying about soldiers like Jesse now, and there are many of them?
Well, the government's saying the same thing over and over again, which is that there's just not enough studies to connect the illnesses veterans are experiencing to burn pit smoke. And the problem is, okay, so after every war, there's an unexplained illness that follows. After Gulf War, Gulf War illness after Vietnam. There's Agent Orange. It's very complicated also to isolate, you know, the toxins that these soldiers are exposed to. But looking at burn pits specifically, it's sort of like a scientific absurdity. It's soldiers were breathing in smoke on a day-to-day basis. I mean, they were just covered in it. The government is purposely delaying and sort of obfuscating these studies and making them more complicated than they need to be. They're getting rid of data. They are telling researchers to throw away certain data. And the real heart of the conflict is that the Department of Veterans Affairs is also giving these veterans their benefits. And so it's going to cost them billions of dollars to treat. And it's only going to be more expensive as time goes on.
Jesse, what's the state of your benefits now? Has your illness been deemed by the military or the VA to be service-connected? Are you covered?
Yes, I'm covered. It was a little over a 4.5-year process from start to finish. The burden of proof fell on me. It's not through the VA. I had to be able to prove all this and then show a service connection in order to get the benefits. And that's the huge stumbling block for a lot of people, because if they don't have a good advocate to help them or their family to push it, a lot of veterans get left behind, especially the ones that are alone.
And Jesse, you filed a lawsuit against KBR, Kellogg Brown and Root, one of the big military contractors that was running a burn pit that got all the way to a Supreme Court review.
Yes, it's a huge class action lawsuit. What all of us are trying to do is hold the contractor accountable. We're not asking for anything extra. I mean, this could have been avoided to a great degree, and I believe that they need to be held accountable, and that's why the lawsuit exists. And we're still waiting to see what's going to happen.
And Jesse, after your service, you did 2 tours in Iraq, as you said.
Yes.
Now, looking back on it, I mean, how do you feel like your country has treated you?
Well, for the most part, I think the country has done well. I think maybe greed through these different companies, we feel betrayed. We were tasked to do a job. We volunteered to do the job, and we did the job. Unfortunately, these are the things that follow you home. I don't have regret other than maybe we could have done something different, but we made the best choices at the time.
Jennifer Percy, there is so much about Jesse's story and about what you're saying that I feel like I've heard before.
Yeah, it's a cycle of sort of historical amnesia that we tend to get caught in when we don't want to face the consequences of certain actions. Burn pits have been used in every war. And so, you know, there were standards actually for waste disposal back in 1978 about not using open burn pits when incinerators were available. And we're still doing it now. And so it's really about regulation and policy and making sure that soldiers have access to the information they need upon homecoming.
Jennifer Percy is a contributing editor for The New Republic. Jennifer Percy, thank you for being here.
Thank you.
And Jesse Baca, thanks to you as well.
You're welcome.
Jesse Baca was a senior master sergeant, 2 tours in Iraq in 2004 and in 2007-2008. And before we leave you today, we want to take a minute to acknowledge one other death and celebrate one other life. Vera Rubin, the pioneering astrophysicist who discovered evidence of dark matter, died on Sunday night. Rubin and her colleague Kent Ford were studying the behavior of spiral galaxies when they saw something that seemed at odds with Newton's laws of gravity. The stars on the outside were moving at the same speed as the ones in the middle, and that can't happen unless there's more mass around than you think. That observation, along with others, eventually led to the discovery that all of that missing mass was dark matter. Rubin had that sense that to begin to understand the cosmos is to open your eyes to how little we really know. She once said, in a spiral galaxy, the ratio of dark to light matter is about a factor of 10, and that's probably a good number for the ratio of our ignorance to knowledge. We're out of kindergarten, but only about in the third grade. It's a humbling thought from scientist Vera Rubin, who worked at the Carnegie Institution in Washington, D.C. until her death at 88. The organization's president called her a national treasure. And that's our show for today. Thanks for listening. I'm Todd Zwillick, in for John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
PRI, Public Radio International.